On November 16, 1989, the world was shocked to learn of the murder of six Jesuits and their two lay colleagues in the Jesuit residence at the University of Central America in El Salvador. The murdered Jesuits were soon seen as victims of a country rent by civil war and as martyrs to the cause of the poor, who had all been forgotten in the midst of the Civil War. Our guest today, Dean Brackley of the Society of Jesus, responded to the murder of his Jesuit brothers by volunteering to serve as one of their replacements, arriving at the university in July 1970, where he's remained ever since. Welcome, Father Brackley, and thank you for joining us.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Please review for our listeners the circumstances surrounding the murder of the Jesuits in 1989.
Well, at the time of the killings 10 years ago, Brian, the war had been dragging on for 9 years, and most were tired of the war, and the guerrillas launched an offensive to try to force a settlement, a peaceful or negotiated settlement. A platoon of the armed forces entered the Jesuit University campus on the night of the 15th and killed the six Jesuits as they were sleeping, dragged them out of the residence, and then killed two women who had asked for shelter at the residence during the time of the offensive.
Could you elaborate a bit on the political situation? You mentioned the guerrillas. What was the position of the government and so on?
Well, the war had been going on for 9 years, as I said, a war mainly because of the tremendous economic disparities, the great majority of people in El Salvador being poor, many landless, and you had a leftist guerrilla movement, and the government opposing them with the support of the United States government during that time.
And what was the U.S. involvement in this?
Well, really, the U.S. was almost daily running the war. The U.S. had been deeply involved in developing strategy and day-to-day operations. There were mainly, it was U.S. advisors who were involved rather than U.S. troops, although there was some troop involvement as well.
Now, there's some tradition of this, of course, in Central America of U.S. involvement, often on the side of rightist or conservative governments. Mm-hmm. This went on for decades, even in El Salvador. Was there anything different about what was going on at this point from what had been going on for decades earlier?
Well, the war broke out in January of 1981. And it was about, the Sandinista government had just overthrown, the Sandinistas had overthrown the government in 1979 in next door Nicaragua. And the United States government feared a domino effect in the region. And so when it became clear that this was a serious threat, this guerrilla movement, the U.S. really fully backed the government with massive military aid, and in fact the guerrillas would have won a military victory around 1985, but the United States massively supported the government and tripled the number of helicopters in a space of about a year in order to turn the tide on that war. And then the United States then continued to support the war in such a way, support the government in such a way that really the conflict was prolonged for many years beyond what it would have been.
So again, not to minimize the seriousness of the situation, but we have here a rather standard story of U.S. involvement out of fear of communist insurgency.
That's right, yeah. This was a Marxist-led guerrilla movement.
Okay. What was the position of the Roman Catholic Church in all of this?
Well, what you had in the country was a polarized population, and with the Catholic Church being certainly the majority religion, you had a polarized church. But within that polarized church, some extremely dedicated and prophetic voices, among them Archbishop Romero, and then later his successor, a number of deeply committed priests, religious sisters, and lay people, who were very outspoken against the government's massive human rights abuses.
Was one wing, would it be correct to identify them as espousing a liberation theology?
I think so. El Salvador is known as one place where liberation theology has been strong, both among intellectuals as well as among poor people, poor believing people.
Would you explain liberation theology a bit for our listeners?
Sure. Liberation theology is simply a reading of Christian faith from the eyes of the poor, through the eyes of the poor, and especially in relation to what they suffer. So more than new contents, it's really a new way of reading the gospel and a way believing people look at the world, especially poor people look at the world. We could say that there are a couple of levels at which liberation theology lives and continues to live in El Salvador and other places. One would be the way the poor themselves express their faith. There's a freshness and a novelty in their expression of the faith in these basic Christian communities, small communities of faith among the poor. But in addition, and here is where the Jesuits were especially influential, liberation theology is also articulated at a more sophisticated or professional or academic level. And the Jesuits were also involved at that level in developing liberation theology.
And do you think that this was behind their murder, their involvement in liberation theology?
Certainly, it was part of that. Every week there would be an editorial in the government-controlled press denouncing liberation theology as Marxist interpretation of the faith, of the gospel. But besides their own theological writings and speaking, a number of these Jesuits were regularly denouncing these massive government abuses of human rights in the course of the war. And they were among the few people in the country who could denounce these abuses with moral credibility and with a certain freedom that came as a result of their status.
Their position would seem to be unimpeachable in many ways, especially, you know, from a religious perspective, yet they were not entirely welcome within the church itself. The church hierarchy seems to have opposed much of this liberation theology activity.
Well, as I said, even on the local level, there were bishops who opposed both them and before them, Archbishop Romero, bishops who unfortunately were more allied with the status quo than with the needs of the poor. And in saying that, I don't mean to suggest that the Jesuits were uncritical of the guerrilla movement either, or that they were simply tools of the guerrillas. They were critical, really, of both sides. But they clearly recognized that the cause of the left was a just cause, with all or whatever abuses might have been involved with the pursuit of the war. And this naturally made them personae non grata in the government, but also provoked a strong reaction from conservative people in the church.
Now, you mentioned earlier Archbishop Oscar Romero, a bit of a, certainly a folk hero, almost mythic in that country. He was also murdered. Could you tell us a little bit about that? When was he murdered, where, and for what purpose?
Sure. Archbishop Romero was killed in March of 1980, so 9 years before the killings of the Jesuits. And these murders really form kind of bookends for the war. This was at the beginning, the outbreak of the war, that Romero was killed. He had been the Archbishop of the capital for 3 years. He had been appointed really as a conservative to try to calm the waters and shore up some of the criticism and the radicalizing of people in the church. And when his close friend, the Jesuit Rutilio Grande, was killed at the beginning of his ministry, it really helped to open Romero's eyes. And he quickly adopted the cause of the poor and recognized that the poor were the object of mass murder campaigns. And Romero then, as you said, became really the voice of the voiceless and the champion of the rights of the poor. And he himself helped to really form a church of the poor and for the poor that walked with the poor. And when, at the end of his ministry, he began to call upon the soldiers to refuse orders to kill the poor, he himself was killed the following day while he celebrated the Eucharist.
Now, you arrived in El Salvador within months of the murder of the Jesuits. What were the conditions when you arrived?
Well, when I arrived in 1990, we were still at war and would remain at war for really 2 years after the killings of the Jesuits. The war is a really dehumanizing reality. I had worked in the inner city here in the States, and I was, if you can be, accustomed to violence, crime. But war is another leap. War is another thing altogether when people are hunting each other for political objectives. And the war during those latter 2 years was also brought home to the capital. It had been waged in the countryside during the earlier years, but during the final years we experienced bombings in the capital, and that is a very tension-producing situation, naturally.
Now, the war is generally seen to, or believed to, have ended in 1992. First of all, do you feel that it was effectively ended in that year, and if so, what changes have you seen since?
Well, the war did formally end in 1992. And then after a 9-month period of kind of armed peace, both sides were effectively disarmed. The guerrillas were completely disarmed, and right now the army has been reduced to about 1/3 of its size. It's still rather large. In that sense, the formal sense, the war has certainly ended, but the peace accords only partially addressed the causes of this war. One thing that is very positive is that the political opposition was admitted into political life. The former guerrillas are now deputies in the National Assembly. They would be like members of Congress in the United States. This is truly revolutionary. At the same time, the peace settlement of 1992 did not address the root, the deepest cause of the war, which was the inequality and the fact that about 100 families control all the productive wealth and capital in El Salvador. This problem has not been addressed, and we continue to suffer a terrible level of violence in the country because former combatants on both sides have not been effectively incorporated into civilian life.
So some political progress, but not much on the social side, certainly when it comes to the poor.
That's correct. And in particular, the strong in El Salvador continue to prey on the weak, and not simply in economics, but throughout the country. This is one of the grave problems that we continue to face in El Salvador.
Are you hopeful at all for the future?
I am hopeful in for two reasons. First of all, I think that the political changes that I mentioned will eventually provide for some checks and balances against the more powerful and ruthless forces in El Salvador. Some checks and balances that can check corruption. And even if we don't have a massive redistribution of power, certainly space will open up in civil society for new initiatives, including initiatives by the poor. And the second thing that is helpful and hopeful, I should say, is the goodness and even the faith of the poor people of this country, people who will give you the shirt off their back, literally, who will share their last tortilla with a visitor, people whose generosity and good humor after all of this suffering really takes your breath away. These people who are notoriously industrious in their generosity are also a source of profound hope. And they are beginning to develop new movements, women's movements, environmental movements, movements of neighbors, the Church of the Poor. Liberation theology is still very much alive and a very important factor, I think, that generates hope in this country.
Well, speaking of generating hope, for our final question, let me take you away from El Salvador just a bit and ask you to comment on Karl Arbeck's recent murder in East Timor, the second Jesuit to be killed in that country. Jesuits seem to willingly put themselves, including yourself, in these dangerous situations. Why?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's fair to generalize that all of us are seeking that type of adventure. But I think part of the Jesuit vocation is to try to escape a life of boredom in favor of a life that somehow responds to the needs of the world. I don't think it's a good idea to irresponsibly place ourselves or needlessly place ourselves in danger. But life is, after all, short, and I think that it's important that we feel useful and needed, and that we do respond to places where people are in danger. And I think this is proper to the vocation of people like ourselves who renounce family, for example, and don't have to worry about our children or our wives. People who have also been privileged, you know, with education, I think it's our job to take risks, right, you know, in favor of people in need.
Well, thank you, Father Brackley. Our best wishes to you upon your return to El Salvador. Please stay safe. You've been listening to Dean Brackley of the Society of Jesus, who teaches at the University of Central America in El Salvador. Diana Jean Shamo of the New York Times talks about her recent examination of the records of the military dictatorships of countries like Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, and Paraguay during the Cold War. Shamo uncovered a web of repression that ensnared anyone who dared challenge those right-wing governments, and she also found troubling ties between those regimes and Washington.
On the eighth floor of the Palacio de Justicia in Asunción, the capital of Paraguay, is a remarkable room. It contains the archives of terror, 5 tons of documents detailing the arrest and interrogations of thousands of prisoners during the 35-year dictatorship of General Alfredo Stroessner. His regime was backed by the United States, which counted on strongmen like Stroessner as a bulwark against the spread of communist revolution in South America. What is most striking about the archives is how few of the people arrested, tortured, and disappeared could be considered candidates for overthrowing the government. There were students killed for protesting increases in bus fares, and doctors who refused to falsify autopsy reports of torture victims. There were human rights activists and union organizers. The records show that a U.S. officer, the late Colonel Robert Thierry, trained members of the principal police unit responsible for torture beginning in 1956, a full 3 years before Castro brought communism to Cuba. The archives also opened the lid on Operation Condor, a secret plan among military regimes of 6 countries, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, and Bolivia, to eliminate political dissent. The members of Condor shared intelligence. They hunted down dissidents who sought sanctuary outside their countries. They assassinated opposition figures wherever they happened to go in the world. Condor was behind the killing in Washington, D.C. of Chile's former defense minister, Orlando Letelier, and his aide, Ronnie Moffitt, an American citizen. It was behind the murders of General Carlos Prats of Chile and General Juan José Torres of Bolivia, both of them killed on a street in Buenos Aires, and there were others. While documents surfacing elsewhere suggest American officials worried about Condor's use of hit squads in Western capitals, the FBI remained on the friendliest of terms with known torturers, like Paraguay's Pastor Coronel, now serving a 25-year sentence for torture. Less than 6 months after Letelier's killing, Clarence Kelly, then director of the FBI, sent Coronel Christmas greetings, wishing him a new year filled with all the good things you so richly deserve. From his office in downtown Washington, Kelly could probably have heard the explosion that blew up the car carrying Letelier and his American aide. Recently, President Clinton apologized for the American role in overthrowing the democratically elected government in Guatemala back in the 1950s, and in supporting a murderous regime that slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Guatemalans over more than 40 years. Separately, he ordered the FBI, CIA, State Department, and the Pentagon to review the records of U.S. involvement in Chile. Some of those records, now declassified, are being forwarded to a Spanish judge who has requested Pinochet's extradition from England for trial in Spain. But inside the United States, there has been surprisingly little interest in investigating or judging the actions of American officials who promoted the use of torture and protected regimes whose principal business was to remain in power. One State Department spokesman asked to arrange an interview with somebody who could explain the American government's behavior in Latin America during the Cold War, said nobody at Foggy Bottom would be interested in speaking, even in general terms. It was, he said, ancient history. Tell that to Carlos Ortiado, Jr., a quiet 26-year-old from Santa Rosa in Paraguay. Carlos was 2 years old when he watched police murder his father, a cotton farmer named Silvano Ortiado. His crime? Trying to organize farmers in his hometown to demand higher prices for their crops. Police tied Ortiado to a tree, battered him with the butt end of a rifle, and slit his throat in front of his wife and 6 children. A week later, a local political boss claimed the family's land and tractor for himself, leaving the Ortiados to survive by peddling empanadas on the street. Everyone in Carlos's house grew up terrified of any political involvement, recoiling from police, too frightened to even ask about the family's land. For them, this history is not ancient at all.
You've been listening to Diana Jean Chamo, reporter for The New York Times.